Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily for Tuesday, May 4th, 2021. On today's episode of the show, we are going to answer some listener questions in the mailbag. My name is Ben Pearson. I'm the senior writer at slashfilm.com, and I'm joined on today's episode by Slash Film managing editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
Weekend editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
And writer Swy Tran Bui.
Hey, everyone.
And Chris Evangelista.
Hi.
All right, guys, so let's get into the mailbag and answer some listener questions. Here we go. First up, Hakim from Los Angeles writes in. He says, I'm curious, what current slash historical event or subculture would you all want to be explored in a film that has not been either a documentary or a narrative? Love the show. Keep up the awesome work. So that's an interesting question. Anybody have any answers locked and loaded here?
Yeah, I'm ready. I got one.
Go for it.
I want the slightly exaggerated story of the ship that blocked the Suez Canal, but I want it told in a extremely R-rated, in-the-loop style political satire comedy.
Oh, man. That is that's a great one. Let's see. Anybody else? The only ones that I was thinking of is, well, the first thing that came to mind was The Devil in the White City, which we talked about in the past and is actually being adapted, I think, into a Hulu limited series, if I remember right. That project has had like quite a winding road on the way to existence, where it was going to be a movie at one point. I think it's supposed to be a series now. Devil in the White City, that the story of H.H. Holmes, the serial killer during the World's Fair, is a really, really great story. The only other one that I could think of was Black Wall Street and the Tulsa Race Massacre, which was depicted in HBO's Watchmen. But I feel like that was one of those moments in pop culture where so many people, myself included, were like, I had no idea this existed. This is wild. And I would love to see that topic sort of explored more deeply in a movie. So, Brad, any thoughts here?
I'm not sure if this necessarily qualifies as historical or subculture, but I think it would be cool to see a movie that dives into the behind-the-scenes controversy when Jay Leno left The Tonight Show and Conan O'Brien took it over, and then Jay Leno took it back from him, because there was a TV movie made by HBO back in 96 that covered the battle between Leno and Letterman to get The Tonight Show after Johnny Carson announced his retirement. And so I think it would be cool to have that as like a pseudo sequel.
Yeah, yeah. HC, Chris, any thoughts on this one?
I feel like I should chime in with something about POC cultures or minority subcultures that have been sorely underrepresented on the screen, but I can't think of many right now. I think this is just because there's a recent Doctor Who episode about this, but there was a great Doctor Who episode about the partition, which I found really fascinating and I feel like could warrant a feature film adaptation in some way. But this was also just fresh in my mind, but I, you know, recently went through all the seasons of The Crown, and The Crown season 2 episode, Vergengenheit. Do you know the one I'm talking about? Where it's revealed that the former King of England, who stepped down to marry the divorcee Wallis Simpson, was involved with the Nazis and had at one point attempted to stage a coup with the Nazis' help. And I remember watching this episode and thinking, wow, this could have been a feature film. This should have been the feature film instead of the King's speech. Like, this is top tier British drama filmmaking.
There is a film about this.
Is
it's
there?
Called W and E for Wallace and Edward, and Madonna directed it, and it's terrible.
Oh, no. I guess careful what you wish for.
I mean, the movie is more about their relationship, and it's portrayed as like this grand sweeping romance, and it overlooks the fact that they were, you know, like Nazi sympathizers and stuff like that. So,
Chris, do you have anything for yourself?
I don't know. Let me just say the one thing I don't want is like, can we not have any like Capitol Riot movies? Like anything, at least for like 20 years. Like, give us like 20 years to. to get over this, because I don't want to see any fucking movies about like the last 4 years. I just can't do it. Like, I want to move on. And like, you know, a few years from now, like 20 years from now, when I'm, you know, on my deathbed, go ahead and release that movie. And my, you know, I won't see it. But for
I hope it's longer than 20 years from now, Chris.
I mean, 20 years if I'm lucky. Let's be real here. It's probably like more like two.
The one other thing that just came to mind, I just remembered when I was in college, my friend and I wrote a pilot, a fake TV pilot for I guess it was some sort of production class that we were in. And it centered on Aaron Burr. And this was well before Hamilton. And I just remember being fascinated by the story of Aaron Burr, because in my history classes growing up, it would be like, there would be, you know, he would try to essentially like take over the country in some form. And then he would disappear for like chapters and chapters, and like 10 or 15 years would go by. And then all of a sudden Aaron Burr would pop back up and try to like, you know, secede from the Union, or, you know, he would get like exiled to some country and then be, you know, one of these guys that, that is just constantly like there in the periphery. So, that I think would be, a fascinating thing to sort of, you know, take him from a supporting player in Hamilton and sort of give him his own narrative there. So,
Ben, is there is like a movie news story that you think would make a great movie? Like a movie set on the day Lord and Miller were fired from Solo, like from their POV, or the entire true sordid tale of the Snyder Cut. You know, who do you cast as Zack Snyder? I'm curious if you guys have any ideas, like, what movie news story in the past 4 or 5 years stands out to you as like something that, once the truth is out there, would make a great movie?
GameStop, obviously. which I think there are at least two movies already in the works. Documentary. But I would say, Ben, to your previous point, I would say arguably that Hamilton is about Aaron Burr. He is arguably the protagonist of it, in a way, telling the story.
Well, that's true. It's a bifurcated story, mm-hmm. and I just want a full on Aaron Burr thing. But yes, your point is well taken. Man, Jacob, that's a fascinating. Maybe like the day that Disney bought Lucasfilm or something. That seems like 2012. That seems like sort of a pivot point for the industry. Maybe you could set some sort of crazy, industry related story in that era. I don't know.
I know we talked about it before, but the book Disney War climaxes with Roy E. Disney essentially turning all the Disney shareholders against Michael Eisner in this sort of coup attempt. And I think that the Roy E. Disney versus Michael Eisner story would make for an incredible movie, but I don't know how you get the rights to be able to talk about any of those people or those companies.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, let's move to our next one. And this is from Matt from New Jersey. He says, hey guys, love the show and appreciate the work that you do, as well as the different perspectives everybody brings. My question is this: what is a movie that you feel you could do a one-person reenactment of? Mine would be School of Rock. While it is not necessarily my favorite movie, I pretty much know it by heart, and I feel that I could perform most of the movie by myself if I had to. Anyway, keep up the great work. So that's Matt from New Jersey. Brad, I feel like you have an option here that I feel like this is something that you've thought about before. Am I wrong?
Oh, for sure. And it's mostly because there were a lot of movies that I watched when I was a kid over and over again on VHS that I still remember so well to this day. A couple Disney movies for sure, Aladdin and The Lion King. And then because I watched these when I was younger, probably younger than I should have, but like I can probably easily do Ferris Bueller's Day Off and Wayne's World by heart if I was forced to do it.
Yeah, Ferris Bueller was my choice as well. Let's see. Chris, do you have any options here?
Yeah, I could do Goodfellas. I could do JFK, and I could probably do Ghostbusters, or like the three. I know like every single word to all of those movies. But also JFK is like 4 hours long, so settle in, everybody.
You're gonna get to see you do Ghostbusters, Chris. It's just like a one-man show.
Yeah, I could do all of them. I mean, I definitely Goodfellas and JFK, because there's and probably Zodiac too at this point.
Oh, yeah.
Really, really long movies I can do for some reason. So, yeah.
What do you got, Jacob?
I have a terrible memory, but back in the day, my brother and I would tag team reenacting Men in Black on car rides. One of us would start speaking all lines of dialogue, and one guitar didn't want to take over. So, give me a time machine, and young me can do Men in Black. that's the one I'll talk. That's the one I'll put my hat in there for.
HC, any one person reenactment options?
This is another one from childhood that I used to watch a billion times. And I don't know why I was so obsessed with it, but the 2003 Peter Pan, I think I still have the opening sequence memorized, and I just knew every word of that movie.
Do you think that one still holds up, Aishi? I never saw that movie. I missed it the first time around.
I think it does. I think it's the best Peter Pan. So.
Wow. Okay.
I mean, if any adults are, you know, not keen on watching a child, you know, fairy tale, basically, Jason Isaacs is excruciatingly hot as Captain Hook. Maybe that's something that doesn't appeal to any of you, actually. But there you go.
All right. Well, Jacob, it's funny you mentioned Men in Black because Matt from New Jersey, he sent in a PS and he said the podcast that he listened to the day that he wrote this email discussed the best opening credit sequences. And he just wanted to add Men in Black as an opening that deserves some love. So we did not mention that when we were having our big discussion about that. And then the next email that we got also references that episode. So this one says, "Hi, Peter and Slash Film crew. I listened to your podcast while making dinner. I really loved the segment at the end of Slash Film Daily episode 875, where Ben, HD, and Chris discussed their favorite opening credit sequences. Film titles have shifted through the years from being main titles, which take place at the beginning of a film or TV show, to main on end titles, which take place at the end. Marvel has taken advantage of this main on end title format for most of their films and shows. One that springs to mind is from Black Panther, and then this person links to that, so I'll put that in the show notes if anybody wants to watch that and refresh their memory. Back to the email, let's see. Main titles seem to be more prevalent in TV shows in recent years. Some great examples of this are Westworld and Game of Thrones. If you're interested in learning more, he puts in a resource there. So basically, the question is, can the crew talk about their favorite main on-end titles from films or TV shows, or their favorite main titles from just normal TV shows? That is from Vince from New Jersey. So let's hear it, guys. Any favorite? Brad, I want to go to you first again, because I feel like you're probably the biggest Marvel. Well, you and Jacob, I guess, are the biggest Marvel heads on this episode of this show. So do you have any Marvel main on end titles that jump out to you specifically?
Gosh, I wasn't thinking of any Marvel ones necessarily. I do think that they're all cool, but outside of the MCU, actually, some of my favorite superhero opening credit sequences are for the original Spider-Man trilogy. Mm. A big part of that, obviously, you know, is the score by Danny Elfman, but they put a lot of work into how those credits came together. One of them has really cool illustrations, and then like it has this like CGI like web path that weaves all the way throughout, and then I think it's the third one that creates like imagery with webs in addition to like featuring clips from the previous movies, almost like a previously on Spider-Man kind of recap. Mm. One of my favorite all-time credit sequences is for Catch Me If You Can, and it's illustrated in like a very retro art style, and then it also has that outstanding score by John Williams too.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, we mentioned that one during that one episode that Vince mentioned here. Aishi, let's go back around the horn to you. Any ones that jump out to you here?
I guess if we're expanding to TV, there's a lot more, isn't there? But the funny thing is, the main on end sequence doesn't jump out to me, but I just thought immediately of the Community opening sequence from A Fistful of Paintballs, where they did a tribute to old Western films, which mm-hmm. I really love. So that one just immediately jumped out to me. The Lost sequence.
it's so simple and so fast.
It's so good. It's just like that. I'm not going to make the noise. I mean, the Game of Thrones sequence is fantastic. I do love that one. I just keep thinking of the Community opening sequence, and also the many opening sequences they did in like their various TV tributes. I remember they did a Law and Order one, which was really fun. I don't have any fun creative ones that I can think of.
Jacob, what about you?
I'll bounce back to your initial question to Brad, which is there a Marvel standout main titles and end sequence? And I'll pick my favorite from the most underrated MCU movie, Avengers Age of Ultron, which is a camera interweaving through a massive Marvel sculpture of all the Avengers doing battle with Ultron. And it originally looks like it's a series of statues being filmed, and then you realize they're all interconnected, and the camera pulls back at the end to reveal this massive sort of Roman style piece of art showcasing all the superheroes, like literally carved out of stone. And it's really impressive and neat and stands out from a lot of the other Marvel end credits sequences. But in terms of non-Marvel ones, I'll do an old favorite and recent favorite. The 2009 Star Trek film ends with lots of cool shots of space and the camera moving through, you know, galaxies and anomalies and nebulas and going past all kinds of planets. And it's timed really well to Michael Giacchino's reorchestration of the classic original series Star Trek theme. And I think about it a lot. I listen to that Giacchino Star Trek theme a lot. So that one stands out to me as, I think, an early example of that being done really well before it became like the norm in blockbusters. A recent one, less than a week old recent one, I think that the Mitchells versus the Machines ends with a really absolutely lovely credit sequence where everybody's credited next to their family photo of them as a young person with their family. Mm-hmm. And it's absolutely wonderful and ties extremely well into what the movie's about. So those are two examples.
Yeah, that's great. Chris, what about you? And we can open it up to TV too, if there's any that jump out to you.
Man, I can't really think of any other than the ones I said on that other episode. I remember the only thing that's coming to mind is the very recent opening to The Last Dance, that documentary where the music is just like really bombastic and it's like edited with people slam dunking. And I was like, yeah, this fucking rule. I don't even like basketball, but that was such a well-made docuseries that every time that opening credits happened, I was like, yes, this is great. And then, another one is I gotta read the name of the show. 30 Coins. It was a recent show on HBO Max that had an opening credit sequence that depicted the execution of Jesus, the crucifixion of Jesus, but it was done through this like horror movie lens where there's like blood everywhere and there are demons with like white eyes, and that was fucking awesome too. Anything that's fucking awesome gets my vote.
That's great. Okay, so the main on end title sequence that I wanted to highlight was the one from Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, which I think is a really great one that really like leans into the project's comic book origins in a way that even the movie doesn't have the ability to do, because it kind of has to be like a visually coherent movie, and the end credits just goes like full blown, like scattered into all sorts of different comic dimensions. And it's really wild and very well done. TV, obviously I love the Game of Thrones one, like Aishi said, but there were two that I wanted to highlight real quick. One is Man Seeking Woman, which is just a show that I think more people should watch. It's on FXX, and I think you can watch it on Hulu right now. It has this really jazzy score for the theme song, really off-kilter animations in the beginning that I like a lot. And then a tie between Veronica Mars and The Wire, just because I love the way that they use the same theme song and how it's reimagined over the course of multiple seasons. I just remember being really... thinking that was a really cool idea. And those are the two shows that I can think of that use that same
thing. I just thought another TV opening that I love, Batman Beyond. Mm. Oh my God.
Oh yeah.
The coolest animated opening sequence with the punk, cyberpunk aesthetic, the cool bass. I think I wrote about this recently in a quarantine stream, and I just raved about the opening sequence because for me at 12 years old, it was the epitome of cool, and it still holds up today. So Batman Beyond.
Yeah, is it cooler than the original Batman animated series opening sequence?
I mean, that Art Deco cool style. Too.
Yeah.
They're both great.
One I just remembered that I want to throw in, and this is more, I guess a little more since it's an on-end sequence, is the 22 Jump Street closing credits, where they go through all the different sequels that followed with scenes and title cards and everything.
Yeah, man, that one, that I love that one. Where, God, just the way that that Ice Cube is like, you two sons of bitches, and they just like insert every possible thing. Oh man, that's a great one.
I honestly I'm still sad that they haven't gotten MIB 23 off the ground, especially since they talked about how they figured out a way to make all of those sequels canon and then make that movie.
All right, so Donnie from Florida has our next question. He says, first of all, love the show. I play a little drinking game where I take a sip whenever Peter says, I don't know. I've been hammered for years now. Just kidding. I was just wondering, what do you guys think are some great movies that fall apart in the third act? Examples for me are Signs and From Dusk Till Dawn. And secondly, the opposite question, movies that you have considered turning off, but then the third act saved them. Examples for me are Hardcore Henry and The Prestige. Again, that's from Donnie. So let's go to Chris this time first. Any options here?
I don't have one that I can think of that gets better in the third act, just because, I don't know, I'm tired. I don't feel like thinking of one. But one that really stands out for me is It Follows, which is a movie everyone loved. And I really liked it too. And then the third act, they like go to like a fucking swimming pool and they're throwing like gadgets in the pool to try and catch the monster. And I was like, God, this is awful, because everything up until that finale where it turns into like Home Alone with a ghost or whatever, I was 100% on board with that movie. And then like the last 20 or 30, I don't even know if you could count it as an act, but it's basically the ending of the movie, just completely shits the bed, in my opinion. And it like soured the whole film for me. I was like, what the like, they literally like shoot the ghost demon, like what the, and it starts bleeding in the pool. I was like, what the fuck is that? I don't know. Like, I feel like the movie, like it didn't have solid enough rules for its monster slash ghost thing, you know, and I feel like they just didn't think about it enough. And as a result of that, the ending just completely falls apart. And that's always bugged me, because, you know, when that came out, everyone was raving about it and I was so excited to see it. And I, you know, I really liked the first two halves of the movie. And I was like, this is going to be one of the best horror movies I've seen in a long time. And then they go to a swimming pool and the whole movie sucks. So that's my opinion.
Yeah, that's a perfect answer for this type of question. Let's see. HC, any great movies that fell apart in the third act, or movies that were pretty bad, but then the ending saved them for you?
So for the first answer, I could only think of a movie that didn't, you know, fall apart completely for me, but definitely had a weaker third act ending, but I still completely adore it. And that's the 2017 Wonder Woman, which many people have had, you know, complaints about that third act. I think that the first two acts is just a perfect superhero movie. I completely just love and adore it. And the third act, while not totally, doesn't make me totally write off the entire movie, it just kind of, you know, drops the ending. No, I can't think of the word, but fumbles the ending.
Yeah, drops the ball.
Yeah, drops the ball, fumbles the ending in a way that doesn't completely tank it, but feels like it misses the point that the first half of the movie was building up to. So yeah, Wonder Woman 2017.
Okay, Brad, how about you?
I would say, and this kind of actually works on a trilogy level as well, but The Matrix Revolutions, man, what a missed opportunity in more ways than one. The climax of the movie itself is just this big CGI mishmash fight that just is such a disappointing ending. And as the third film in the overall franchise, it really just shit the bed when it has such an awesome setup from Matrix Reloaded that created so many cool paths they could have taken. And it's just a very bland, boring, computer-generated ending.
Quick side question for you, Brad. What do you think about Matrix 4? Are you excited about that?
I'm curious. You know, I think it's interesting that they're bringing the franchise back, and I'm reserving any excitement, judgment, what have you, until we get to see the first frame in a teaser trailer. So hoping for the best.
Okay. Jacob, any options here?
Oh, the listener wrote in with Signs, which I do not think craps a bed in its final stretch, but I'll respond with a M. Night Shyamalan movie I think does, and that is The Village. I think is so creepy, so atmospheric, so beautiful and weird. And then that damn third act plot twist of they were in modern day all along is just...
I love it, Jacob. I have to tell you, I love this movie.
I'm a big fan.
I think it undercuts all... Everything that made the movie scary is completely undone by that. The fact that the scariest moments from the first half of that movie are, oh, is William Hurt in a monster costume? Woo! Oh, fuck off. Hate the
Village. Jacob, no.
Jacob, the real monsters are the people.
You joke, Brad, but come on. It's well done, damn it.
I'm just going to say I love the ending of The Village. I love The Village in general. It's actually my favorite M. Night Shyamalan movie.
Man. I'm sorry to bring the cold, hard hammer of truth down upon this last
Team Village. Podcast. Team The Village.
All right, now I'm distracted. Is there anybody here that I have not gotten to with this question?
I have my movie saved by a third act. Sorry, a movie saved by a third act.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
This is an interesting one. It's not a well-known movie, but it's a film called Penumbra, I believe it's a Spanish horror film I saw at a film festival a decade ago. And I remember watching it and being so incredibly bored and frustrated by it, but not having quite enough nerve to walk out. So I went to the restroom. I took my sweet time. I checked my phone out in the hallway a few times before I went back in. I left the theater multiple times, bored out of my mind, trying to wait. I thought, is this worth sitting out? Then in the last 20 minutes, Penumbra gets really interesting. And you realize that the incredibly boring first hour is actually an intentional atmospheric device to set in place what happens in the final stretch. I'm not saying it was worth it, but I am saying that I admire the nerve of a filmmaker who tests your patience for an hour to make the last 20 minutes pay off. So Penumbra.
Well, along those same lines, Jacob, I think One Cut of the Dead is another movie that, I mean, if you go into that movie not knowing anything about it, I think could sort of fall in those same parameters for people, where like people might think it's so bad and I'm going to turn this off. But if you stick it out, then the third act, or really the back half of the movie, sort of redeems everything you've seen before, and not only redeems it, but like puts it in an entirely new context that makes it even better if you were to rewatch the entire thing. So that's a good option, I think, for the second part of that question. For me, for the first part, a great movie that falls apart in the third act, I think my go-to answer here would be Stripes, the Bill Murray comedy. I don't know, Brad, I know you're a big Bill Murray guy. Do you have any thoughts on Stripes? Because the first half is like all army stuff, and then you know, them like being in boot camp and all of that, and then the back half actually turns into like this weird like man on a mission kind of war movie that just is not nearly as funny as the first half of the film. What do you think about Stripes?
Yeah, Stripes is a weird one, because I know a lot of people have an affinity for it just because it's kind of a classic Bill Murray comedy, but I do agree that it does have this weird gear shift where it goes from being like an Animal House-esque military comedy to having a purpose, I guess, and it just it feels very, very odd. It doesn't ruin it for me, but it's a big reason why Stripes, I don't love it as much as, you know, something like an Animal House or a Caddyshack or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. All right, so let's get to our last question of the day. And this one comes from James from Manila, Philippines. He says, "Hello, Slash Film Team. As a self-proclaimed film buff, I'm a firm believer that movies are capable of shaping one's life. With that, I'd like to know, what are some life-changing films which you guys can recommend? By life-changing films, I'm talking about movies that you guys have personally resonated with, so much so that it changed the way you perceived life or how you treat other people. I'd love to have some insight as to what films shaped the life of my favorite movie critics. Love the podcast, love your works, and thank you." So that's from James. Thank you, James, for that question. Yeah, I mean, this is a big one, guys, that we're ending on here. Life-changing movies. I mean, I was saying in the Slack before we started recording that it's like almost impossible to recommend a film that you think is going to change someone's life, because everybody's so different and movies hit you different ways at different points in your life. But maybe if we take it out of the macro and bring it into the micro a little bit and just talk about movies that changed our lives in some way, might be more instructive for this question. Mm-hmm. Jacob, let's start with you this time.
Yeah, this is a surprisingly recent one. Probably the most recent movie to have a fundamental aspect in how I live my life. And that's Jordan Peele's Get Out. I mean, I had sort of an academic knowledge of institutionalized racism. Like, I was aware of it. Naturally, you know, as any self-proclaimed, you know, liberal would, but the conversation surrounding Get Out and what it stirred in people and what people got out of it and wrote about it and discussed about it really clarified a lot of things that I acknowledged and understood, but didn't really comprehend as deeply as I could have or should have. And it really has been a film I think about over the past 5 years of American history. And I just fundamentally think that it opened the door to people like me who always were well-intentioned, really truly understanding concepts that, like I said, felt academic and not, you know, as raw as they should have. So that's one that, you know, fundamentally changed the way that I look at American life every single day.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great one. Chris, let's go to you next. Do you have any?
I do, and this one is a big one for me that changed my life a lot, and it's Okja, the Bong Joon-ho movie, because before that, I was sort of considering being a vegetarian. I definitely did not eat pork. I still occasionally ate beef, and then I saw that movie, which is a great movie, but the last, like, act of that film is set in this, like, nightmarish slaughterhouse, and they're showing all these things going on to these they're called super pigs in the movie, but they're basically like big cuddly animals. And just seeing that unfold, it literally like fucking traumatized me to the point where, one, I can never like watch that movie again, and two, I was like, all right, I am done eating any sort of meat and fish, anything that's alive, basically, I don't eat. Mm-hmm. So that was it. And I've never like once been like, I gotta go back and eat meat again. Like, you know, I just gave it up just because of that movie. It just upset me so much. And you know, those animals weren't even real, so I can't even imagine. Like, you know, I was able to plug that movie's, you know, vibe into just thinking about eating living things. I just can't do it. And you know, I just want to add, I'm not like militant about this. I know a lot more people just can't give up meat and they don't want to, and you know, that's fine. I try not to be like, you know, my wife still eats meat. I don't like, you know, give her cold hard stares or anything like that. But you know, just for me personally, I just can't do it. I can't go back. It just upsets me too much. So that's the big one for me.
Okay. Let's go to HG next. Any life-changing films for you?
This is another sort of recent one as well. It has both to do with me and also my larger family. So there's, you know, been a shift in Hollywood lately where there's been a lot more Asian-led films and a lot more minority-led films. But for me and my family, it kind of started with the Pixar movie Coco. And I've written for this a little bit on the site. There's a piece I wrote from like the early press day I did where I talked about the shared customs of honoring ancestors within Coco and recognized within my own culture. And I basically had this sort of shared experience when I watched Coco with my family where my family, my uncles, my aunts, my parents were like, wow, we really need to put an effort into making sure that we retain those ties to our past and to each other. And it was a movie that just really touched me and really moved me. And I saw it several times by myself with my family. And I felt like it helped grow that connection with my family because of that. So yeah, just it inspired, for example, my uncle to start documenting his parents and whatever happened with his grandparents and his most recent family and that kind of stuff, and to celebrate Dzol, which is the Vietnamese ceremony for honoring ancestors on their death day more often, and to do it more vigilantly, and just kind of that it brought us together, and I really love it for that, and that's something that just sticks out to me the most for being life changing that way. It really did change a lot of my life.
What a cool thing that movies can inspire. Man, that's great. Brad, what about you? Any life changers?
So this one is a little bit of a hokey one, but I appreciated it as soon as I heard it in this movie. And it's simple, but I appreciate just, I don't know, the perspective that it provides. And it comes from the movie About Time. And if you don't know, it follows Domhnall Gleeson as this young guy who learned that there's this genetic ability for the men in their family to be able to travel through time. And so occasionally he goes back and like revisits certain days to try and make them turn out a little bit better and just make his life a little bit more agreeable and just sort things out. But then as time goes on, he realizes that he can't travel back in time so much because it changes things in his present that he doesn't want to change. And eventually, he learns this like lesson from his dad that to live, you know, any day, you know, initially with all the problems and tension and woes that it comes with, and then go back and live the day essentially exactly the same, but just then taking notice of all the things that you don't the first time around because you're so caught up in the moment and thinking about that. But then at the end, it kind of takes it a step further where he says that he just tries to live every day as if he's deliberately come back to that one day to enjoy it as if it's just like this full day, you know, that he already mm-hmm. knows what's going to happen and not worry about it. And so it's a little bit hokey and cheesy, but I've always appreciated that. And then I guess on a little bit more of a like personal level, it's first of all, this movie had an impact on me in a couple of different ways. The movie's Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. And first of all, it was one of the first movies I saw my senior year in high school that kind of opened up my taste and perspective, and I started seeking out more independent like movies, more low key dramas and things like that. But this movie also was one that like I had latched onto because of the relationship at the center of it. And I initially viewed the movie in this way as this sort of like fateful romance that existed between Jim Carrey and Kate Winslet's characters, that no matter what came between them, they always ended up finding themselves coming back together. Even after they erase each other from their memories, they still end up meeting each other again. And I perceived it as, you know, essentially what is a tragic but beautiful love story. But then, not too long ago, I want to say like a few years, I had been listening to Pete Holmes' podcast, You Made It Weird, and Kumail Nanjiani was on it. And I had never heard anybody with this perspective before, so forgive me if it's naive and other people did perceive it this way, but Kumail talked about how he saw Eternal Sunshine as being simply tragic, because you have these two people who are wrong for each other, but they keep trying this relationship and trying to make it work, and they keep repeating it, and it keeps failing no matter what. And when I heard that, it was kind of a revelation in my own life, because there was a relationship I had like a decade ago that was a troublesome one for me, and it was hard to shake. And it was something that if I had had that perspective back then, I might have seen things a little bit differently. And it's a similar kind of thing where, to me, it felt like it was something that just needed like time to work to figure out, but really it was just a bad relationship for me. And ever since I heard that perspective, I looked at Eternal Sunshine with a different perspective. And I can see both sides, and I think that both actually make sense, which is one of the great things about how we perceive movies. But yeah, that's how that movie was kind of life-changing for me in a couple different ways.
Yeah, man, that's a good one too. So I think my answer would be sort of in that similar vein, Brad, in terms of like how Eternal Sunshine like inspired you to seek out other things. I certainly had, I grew up on a steady diet of blockbusters and like mainstream studio movies, basically like Hollywood films. And there's a film in 2005 that came out called Man Push Cart that was directed by Ramin Barani that I saw when I was in college. A professor said, you know, if you go see an independent film at a theater, I'll give you extra credit in this class. And I just did it sort of on a lark, and was very affected by the movie, because it was the first time I'd ever seen an indie movie, maybe ever, certainly in the theaters. I may have seen like a couple, you know, here and there before then, you know, stuff that's not like, you know, like Pulp Fiction is technically like an indie film, but I'm talking about like really, really indie movies, you know? Watching Man Push Cart didn't change my behaviors in any way, because the film is about a Pakistani immigrant who essentially runs a bagel and coffee cart in Manhattan. So it's not like seeing this movie, you know, made me like treat people any differently or anything like that, as this question sort of is trying to get at. But it just opened my eyes to a whole different experience, and put independent film, it made it an option for me, whereas before I just like almost ignored it completely out of ignorance, I think. So that's not like a super like personal life-changing kind of thing, but it's a turning point, I think, in my like cinematic education, if you want to call it that. So yeah, there we go. All right, I think that's it. I think that's going to bring us to the end of today's episode of Slash Film Daily. If you guys want to send in more emails, more mailbag questions, I would love it if you did that. You can send your feedback, questions, comments, concerns, and those mailbag topics to us at peter@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. Slash Film Daily is published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on slashfilm.com. You can subscribe to this show on Apple, Google, Overcast, Spotify, all of the popular podcast apps. Don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Tell your friends, spread the word. Thank you all for listening, and we will talk to you tomorrow.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.